Welcome to our deep dive into the global burden of disease. Now, I know that sounds a little intimidating, but it's really just a way to kind of wrap our heads around the impact of diseases and injuries on populations around the world. You know, it's kind of like a giant health checkup for the whole planet. And you've shared some really interesting research with us. I think it'll be fascinating to see what's changed over time.
Yeah, you know, it's always interesting to see how these things shift, especially when we look past just simple death rates. The global burden of disease, or GBD as it's called, helps us to understand the true toll of different conditions. But considering both the years of life lost from early death and the years lived with a disability, it really paints a much more complete picture of global health.
Right. It's not just about how many people die from something. It's also about how much suffering it causes for people who are living with these conditions. That's where the idea of disability-adjusted life years or DALYs comes in. It sounds complicated, but I think you had a really great way of explaining it.
Yeah, it can seem kind of complex, but it's actually pretty simple. Think of it like this. If somebody loses, say, 10 years of life because of disease, that's 10 years lost. But what if someone lives with a severe disability for 20 years because of that same disease? Obviously, their quality of life and their ability to work and live a fulfilling life is affected. Mm-hmm. So those years also carry a burden. And so DALYs basically combine those years of life lost with years lived with a disability to give us a single number that represents the impact of that condition.
So a higher DALY score basically means a bigger problem for overall health. And to kind of help organize all this data, the GBD organizes diseases and injuries into three main groups.
Exactly. Group one covers all the things you can catch. So infectious diseases like HIV, tuberculosis, malaria, as well as issues related to pregnancy, newborns, and nutrition. Group two includes the chronic conditions that can't be spread from person to person, things like heart disease, cancer, diabetes, and mental illnesses. And finally, group three is all about injuries. And that includes everything from car accidents to falls to self-harm.
Okay, so we've got our three main categories. What really stands out to you when we start looking at how these burdens are distributed around the world?
I think one of the most striking patterns is how the leading causes of death are different between high-income countries and low-income countries. In a lot of low-income countries, communicable diseases from group one, things like HIV, tuberculosis, and malaria, are still major killers.
It's really shocking to see that globally, 38 million people are living with HIV, and almost 20% of them don't even know they have it. And even in a high-income country like Canada, 14% of people living with HIV are unaware of their status, which is a huge problem because it means they're not getting the treatment they need to stay healthy and also to prevent further transmission.
Absolutely. It really highlights the importance of access to testing and treatment, which unfortunately is often limited in low-income countries. But even within high-income countries like Canada, we see these disparities where indigenous populations experience a much higher burden of certain diseases compared to the general population.
Yeah, and that's concerning. For example, TB rates in First Nations, people living on reserves, are over 40 times higher than in non-Indigenous Canadians. And we see similar disparities with HIV as well.
Right, and this is where the idea of social determinants of health comes in. These are the social and economic factors that can influence people's health, like things like poverty, education, housing, and access to health care. All of these factors can create significant barriers to good health, and they really contribute to the disparities that we see between different populations.
So in the case of Indigenous communities in Canada, things like overcrowded housing, lack of access to clean water and nutritious food, and limited access to healthcare all contribute to those higher rates of TB and HIV.
Exactly. They create an environment where diseases can thrive. But it's not just about being vulnerable to disease. These factors also make it harder for people to manage their health conditions once they have them.
It's a vicious cycle. It makes you wonder, are there other examples where these social determinants are playing a role in the global burden of disease?
Well, absolutely. We'll definitely dive into more examples as we go through the different disease categories. But before we move on from communicable diseases, I think it's important to highlight a positive story. You might remember at the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic, there were a lot of concerns about remote Indigenous communities being hit really hard by the virus, but they actually had a much lower infection rate compared to the general population.
That's right. They really took charge of the situation.
They did. Their swift action and their community-based approaches, and in a lot of cases, their use of traditional knowledge were really key factors in their success. I think it's a powerful example of resilience and proactive public health measures.
It shows that even when faced with a global pandemic, communities can find ways to protect themselves. Okay, so we've talked about group one, the communicable diseases. Let's shift our focus now to group two, non-communicable diseases, or NCDs. What are we seeing in terms of global trends there?
Well, this is where we see a really interesting shift happening. Globally, NCDs have become the leading cause of death. And this is partly because people are living longer, thanks in part to advances in medicine and public health. But as people live longer, they become more susceptible to chronic conditions, like heart disease, cancer, and diabetes.
It's almost like a double-edged sword. We're living longer, but that also means we're living longer with these chronic illnesses.
Exactly. And while increased lifespan plays a role, lifestyle changes are also major contributors to the rise of NCDs, things like unhealthy diets and a lack of physical activity.
It's so fascinating how these global trends in health are really evolving. I'm curious to see how these changes are playing out differently in different parts of the world. Let's dive into some specific examples of NCDs and see what we find.
Okay, great. Let's start with cardiovascular disease, or CVD. It might surprise you to learn that CVD is the number one killer worldwide. We often think of it as a modern problem, but it affects people across the globe.
That is surprising. What are some of the factors that are contributing to this global epidemic of CVD?
Well, as we mentioned earlier, people are living longer, which means there's more time for these chronic conditions to develop. But lifestyle factors play a huge role as well. Unhealthy diets that are high in things like saturated fat, trans fat, and cholesterol, along with a lack of physical activity, all increase the risk of developing CVD.
I imagine stress plays a role too, right?
Yeah.
Especially with our busy modern lives.
Absolutely. Stress can contribute to high blood pressure, which is a major risk factor for CVD. And speaking of risk factors, social determinants of health also play a significant role here. We tend to see higher rates of CVD in lower-income communities, where access to healthy food and opportunities for physical activity are often limited.
So it's that same pattern we saw with communicable diseases. Those social and economic factors are putting certain populations at greater risk. It really highlights the need for a more equitable approach to health. What about cancer? What's the global picture there?
Well, cancer is another major contributor to the global burden of disease. Globally, the chances of developing cancer in your lifetime are 1 in 3 for men and 1 in 4 for women. But those odds change drastically based on where you live.
Yeah, I saw that in the research you shared. It's almost like playing the lottery, but it's a lottery you don't want to win, and your chances of winning are higher depending on your income level.
It's a good analogy. In the poorest countries, the odds of developing cancer are about 1 in 7, while in the wealthiest countries, they jump to a staggering 1 in 2.
Wow. That is a really stark difference. What's driving that disparity? Is it just about access to healthcare?
Access to healthcare is definitely a factor, especially access to early detection and treatment. But it's also about exposure to risk factors. In lower income countries, people are more likely to be exposed to environmental carcinogens, like air pollution and contaminated water. They might also have less access to healthy food and preventative healthcare services.
So it's really a combination of factors: genetics, lifestyle, and environment. And again, those social determinants of health are playing a big role in shaping those cancer statistics. It's a sobering reminder of the complex interplay between health and inequality.
It is. And it's also important to remember that cancer is not a single disease. It's actually a group of diseases with different causes and risk factors. Some cancers, like lung cancer, are strongly linked to lifestyle choices like smoking, while others, like cervical cancer, can be prevented through vaccination. Understanding these nuances is crucial for developing effective prevention and treatment strategies.
It sounds like there's a lot of work to be done in terms of addressing the global burden of cancer. But before we move on to group three injuries, I want to circle back to something we mentioned earlier, mental health. Where does that fit into the picture of non-communicable diseases?
That's a great question. Mental health is a critical component of overall well-being. And mental illnesses contribute significantly to the GBD. Conditions like depression and anxiety can have a huge impact on a person's ability to work, study, and really just engage in meaningful relationships.
It's true. We often focus so much on physical health, but mental health is just as important. And it's something that affects people of all ages, all over the world.
Absolutely. And just like physical health, mental health is influenced by a complex interplay of factors, including genetics, life experiences, and again, those social determinants of health. We see higher rates of mental illness in populations that are experiencing poverty, discrimination, and social isolation.
It makes sense. If you're constantly struggling to meet your basic needs or facing systemic barriers, it's going to take a toll on your mental health. It's another reminder of how interconnected our physical, mental, and social well-being really are.
Exactly. And addressing the burden of mental illness really requires a holistic approach that considers all of those different factors.
Okay, so we've covered a lot of ground with communicable and non-communicable diseases. Let's move on now to group three injuries. I have to admit, this category seems a little less daunting compared to the complexities of these chronic diseases we've been talking about.
It might seem that way at first glance, but injuries actually present a unique set of challenges. Globally, injuries account for about 7.6% of all deaths, which might sound relatively small compared to the other categories, but there are some interesting nuances when we look at the data.
Oh, really? Like what?
One striking observation is the gender gap in injury deaths. Males are almost twice as likely to die from injuries compared to females, and this is likely influenced by a combination of factors, including differences in risk-taking behavior, occupational hazards, and societal norms surrounding masculinity.
That makes sense. And I also noticed that suicide is included in this category. It's a tragic reality that we need to...
Absolutely. Suicide is a significant contributor to injury deaths globally, and it's particularly prevalent in certain populations. We've already talked about the higher suicide rates among Indigenous populations in Canada, but this is an issue that extends far beyond any one group.
It's heartbreaking to think about. What are some of the factors that contribute to these higher suicide rates?
Well, just like with other health issues, suicide is a complex phenomenon influenced by multiple factors. Mental illness is a significant risk factor, particularly depression and substance abuse. But social factors also play a role, things like unemployment, poverty, and social isolation.
And we can't forget about the impact of historical trauma and systemic discrimination, especially for marginalized communities. It's all interconnected.
It is. And addressing suicide requires a multifaceted approach that includes promoting mental health awareness, improving access to mental health services, and addressing the social and economic factors that contribute to despair and hopelessness.
It's a big challenge, but one that we can't ignore. Okay, so we've covered a lot of ground in this first part of our deep dive. We've explored the three main categories of the GBD and started to uncover some of the complex factors that shape global health patterns.
It's a lot to take in, but I think we're starting to see the big picture here. The global burden of disease is not just about numbers and statistics. It's about people's lives, their hopes, their struggles, their triumphs, and their tragedies. And by understanding these complexities, we can start to work towards a healthier future for everyone.
Welcome back to our deep dive into the global burden of disease. In part one, we explored the three main categories of the GBD and how those burdens are distributed differently around the world. So now I think it's time to kind of shift gears a little bit and delve deeper into some of the factors that contribute to these global health challenges.
Okay, so we're getting into the why behind the numbers.
Yeah.
What's driving these patterns of disease and disability that we see worldwide? I mean, we touched on some of the social and economic factors in part one, but I'm really curious to explore that connection a little bit further. Yeah, you're right. We did talk about those social determinants of health, and they really are at the heart of many global health disparities. One of the most significant factors is socioeconomic status, or SES. It's a way of measuring someone's position in society based on their income, their education, and their occupation.
Right. It's basically like where you stand on the social and economic ladder. And we've already seen how that can influence someone's risk for certain diseases, like those higher rates of TB and HIV in communities facing poverty.
Exactly. And research has consistently shown a strong link between lower SES and a higher risk of both communicable and non-communicable diseases. And it's not just about having access to healthcare, although that's certainly a part of it. It's also about the daily realities of living in poverty.
So things like living in overcrowded housing, struggling to afford nutritious food, having limited access to education and job opportunities, all those factors that create this kind of cycle of disadvantage.
Precisely. And those disadvantages can have a direct impact on health. I mean, for example, if you can't afford healthy food, you're more likely to develop nutritional deficiencies, which can weaken your immune system and make you more susceptible to infections. Or if you live in a neighborhood with high crime rates, you might not feel safe going for a walk or taking your kids to the park, which obviously limits your opportunities for physical activity.
It's almost like poverty itself becomes a risk factor for disease.
In a way, it does.
Yeah.
And the impact goes beyond just physical health. Lower SES is also linked to higher levels of stress, which can contribute to mental health problems like anxiety and depression.
So it's like this cascade effect. poverty leads to stress, which leads to unhealthy behaviors, which then increases the risk of both physical and mental health problems. It's a vicious cycle.
It is. And this cycle is particularly evident when we look at non-communicable diseases, or NCDs. Like, think about heart disease, for example. We know it's the leading cause of death globally. And studies have shown that people with lower SES are disproportionately affected.
We talked earlier about how lifestyle factors like unhealthy diets and lack of exercise can contribute to heart disease. But are you saying that poverty itself increases those risks?
Yes, in several ways. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're working multiple jobs to make ends meet, you might not have the time or energy to cook healthy meals or go for a run. Fast food is often cheaper and more convenient, but it's also loaded with saturated fat, trans fat, and sodium, all of which contribute to heart disease.
And if you live in a neighborhood without safe parks or walking trails, it's that much harder to get that physical activity. That's so crucial for heart health. It's like your environment is almost working against you.
Exactly. The environment plays a huge role in shaping our health behaviors. But it's not just about individual choices. There's also a systemic component to these disparities.
What do you mean by systemic?
Well, I'm talking about the policies and practices that create barriers to good health for certain populations. For example, think about food deserts. These are areas where access to fresh, affordable produce is limited and are often found in lower-income neighborhoods, which makes it harder for residents to make healthy choices.
That's so unfair. It's like the system is setting people up for failure.
It's a complex issue, and it's not just about food access. Think about the aggressive marketing of unhealthy products, like sugary drinks and processed foods, that often target lower-income communities. These marketing campaigns can really influence people's choices and contribute to unhealthy eating habits.
It's like they're constantly bombarded with messages that are promoting unhealthy behaviors. It's no wonder that we see these disparities in heart disease and other NCDs.
It really is. And it's a reminder that health is not just about individual responsibility. It's also about the social, economic, and environmental factors that shape our choices and our opportunities.
So what can we do about it? I mean, if these systemic factors are so deeply ingrained, is there any hope for change?
Absolutely. There's a lot we can do. I think it starts with recognizing that these disparities exist, and that they're not simply a matter of personal choice. We need to address the underlying social and economic conditions that contribute to these poor health outcomes.
Okay, so we need to address the root causes, but what does that look like in practice? What kind of solutions are we talking about?
Well, there are many different approaches, but I think one of the most important is investing in public health. Public health interventions are policies and programs that are designed to improve the health of entire populations, not just individuals.
Right, public health. It's about prevention and promoting healthy behaviors at a community level.
Exactly. And these interventions can take many forms, from educational campaigns to policy changes to environmental modifications. For example, we could implement taxes on sugary drinks to discourage consumption. Or we could invest in building parks and walking trails to make physical activity more accessible.
Those are great examples, but it sometimes feels like those kinds of interventions face a lot of resistance, especially when they involve things like government regulation or spending.
That's true. Public health initiatives can definitely be controversial, especially when they challenge powerful industries or require people to make lifestyle changes. But there's a growing body of evidence showing that these interventions can be incredibly effective.
Can you give us an example?
Sure. Take smoking, for instance. In the mid-20th century, smoking was incredibly common, and lung cancer rates were skyrocketing. But through a combination of public education campaigns, smoking bans in public places, and increased taxes on cigarettes, smoking rates have plummeted, and lung cancer rates have declined significantly.
That's a really powerful example of how public health interventions can make a real difference, and it shows that change is possible, even when it comes to deeply ingrained behaviors.
Exactly. And the same principles can be applied to other health challenges, like obesity, heart disease, and even mental illness.
So it's about creating an environment where healthy choices are the easier choices. It's not about forcing people to change, but about making it easier for them to make those changes.
Exactly. And this approach requires a multifaceted strategy. We need to promote healthy lifestyles, create supportive environments, and improve access to healthcare. It's about empowering people to take control of their own health and giving them the resources they need to succeed.
Okay, so let's break that down a little bit. Promoting healthy lifestyles, what does that entail?
Well, it might sound pretty straightforward, but it's more than just telling people to eat their vegetables and exercise more. It's about creating educational campaigns that are culturally relevant and accessible, and making healthy choices the easy choices.
So like making fresh produce more affordable and available in lower-income neighborhoods. Or offering cooking classes that teach people how to prepare healthy meals on a budget.
Exactly. We need to think creatively about how to make healthy options appealing and accessible to everyone. But we also need to be realistic. We live in a world where unhealthy food is often cheaper and more convenient than healthy food, and that's where policy interventions come in.
You're talking about things like taxes on sugary drinks or restrictions on the marketing of unhealthy foods to children.
Exactly. Sometimes a little nudge from policymakers can help to tip the scales in favor of healthier choices. It's not about taking away people's freedom, but rather about creating a fairer playing field.
Okay, that makes sense. So we've talked about promoting healthy lifestyles. What about creating supportive environments? What does that entail?
Well, it's all about making it easier for people to be healthy, regardless of their socioeconomic status or where they live. It's about thinking about health in a more holistic way, recognizing that our surroundings can have a huge impact on our well-being.
So investing in things like parks and recreation facilities, ensuring that there are safe walking and biking routes, promoting access to affordable housing, basically creating communities that are designed to support health and well-being.
Exactly. Just imagine a community where fresh food is readily available, the streets are safe for walking and biking, and there are plenty of opportunities for recreation and social connection. In that kind of environment, healthy choices become the natural choices.
It sounds idyllic, but realistically, how do we get there from where we are now? Especially when you consider all the complexities of urban planning and the costs involved in making those kinds of changes.
It's definitely a challenge, but it's not an insurmountable one. It requires a shift in mindset, a recognition that investing in healthy communities is not just a nice to have, it's a necessity. It's about prioritizing the well-being of all residents and creating spaces that promote physical, mental, and social health.
It's a long-term vision, but definitely one worth striving for. And finally, we have improving access to healthcare. That seems like a no-brainer.
It does. But it's not always as simple as it sounds. Access to healthcare isn't just about having insurance or a clinic nearby. It's also about having culturally competent providers, affordable care, and convenient locations. It's about feeling respected and understood by your healthcare providers and having confidence in the system.
Right. And we've talked about how historical trauma and systemic discrimination have really eroded trust in the healthcare system for many marginalized communities, particularly indigenous populations.
Exactly. And building that trust requires a deep understanding of the historical context and a willingness to work in partnership with communities to address their specific needs. It's about creating healthcare systems that are equitable, inclusive, and really responsive to the diverse needs of the population.
So we're talking about not just building more hospitals, but also about building better relationships and dismantling those systemic barriers that prevent people from accessing the care they need.
Precisely. It's about a fundamental shift in how we approach healthcare, a shift from a reactive disease-focused model to a proactive health-focused model.
A shift from treating illness to preventing it in the first place.
Exactly. And that requires a collaborative approach involving not just healthcare professionals, but also educators, social workers, policymakers, and community members themselves.
It's about recognizing that health is a shared responsibility and that we all have a role to play in creating a healthier world.
Absolutely. And that brings us back to the GBD. By understanding the factors that contribute to disease and disability, we can develop more effective interventions to address these challenges and ultimately improve the health of populations worldwide. It's not just about treating the symptoms. It's about addressing the root causes and creating a world where everyone has the opportunity to thrive.
It's amazing how much impact those social and economic factors really have on global health. It's like we're seeing the same patterns emerge again and again, whether we're talking about communicable diseases or NCDs or even injuries.
Yeah, it really highlights the fact that health is not just about biology. It's about the context in which people live their lives, the opportunities they have, the challenges they face, the resources they can access.
So if we want to make real progress in addressing the global burden of disease, we need to go beyond just medical interventions. We need to address those underlying social and economic inequities.
Exactly. And that brings us to the concept of health equity. It's about ensuring that everyone has a fair and just opportunity to be healthy, regardless of their race, their ethnicity, their gender, socioeconomic status, or any other factor that might put them at a disadvantage.
So it's not just about equality, treating everyone the same, but about equity, recognizing that some people need more support than others to level the playing field.
Precisely. It's about understanding that different groups face different barriers to good health and tailoring interventions to meet their specific needs.
Can you give us an example of what that might look like in practice?
Sure. Let's go back to the example of Indigenous communities in Canada. We talked about the higher rates of TB and HIV in those communities and how those rates are linked to social determinants of health, like poverty, overcrowded housing, and limited access to health care.
Right. And we also saw how those same communities were able to successfully mitigate the impact of COVID-19 through swift action, community-based approaches, and the use of traditional knowledge.
Exactly. That's a great example of a health equity approach in action. Instead of simply applying a one-size-fits-all solution, they recognized the unique needs of those communities, and they empowered them to take control of their own health. They incorporated traditional healing practices alongside Western medicine, they fostered community involvement, and they prioritized culturally relevant communication.
It's about recognizing that communities often know what's best for themselves and have the capacity to lead their own health initiatives.
Absolutely. And that principle applies globally. When we talk about addressing the global burden of disease, we need to move away from those top-down approaches and embrace solutions that are community-driven, culturally appropriate, and responsive to local context.
It's about empowering communities to be active participants in their own health and well-being.
Precisely. And that brings us to the importance of collaboration. Addressing the GBD is a complex undertaking that requires a multi-sectoral approach. It's not just about healthcare providers. It's also about educators, social workers, policymakers, community leaders, and individuals themselves.
It's about working together to create a web of support that promotes health at every level.
Exactly. And this collaborative approach is reflected in the Sustainable Development Goals, or SDGs, adopted by the United Nations in 2015.
Right, the SDGs. It's like a blueprint for a more sustainable and equitable world.
Exactly. And several of the SDGs specifically target health, recognizing that health is essential for overall well-being and sustainable development.
So we're talking about goals like reducing child mortality, ending epidemics of major communicable diseases, promoting mental health and well-being, and ensuring universal access to healthcare.
Precisely. And the SDGs acknowledge that health is interconnected with other aspects of sustainable development, like poverty reduction, education, gender equality, and environmental protection.
It's like that domino effect again, but this time in a positive direction. By improving health, we can trigger a cascade of positive outcomes across other areas of society.
Exactly. And that's why the SDGs emphasize a holistic and integrated approach to development. They call for collaboration across sectors and disciplines, recognizing that we can't solve these complex challenges in isolation.
It's a reminder that we're all interconnected and that our actions have ripple effects, not just within our own communities, but across the globe.
Absolutely. And that brings us to the role of international cooperation. The global burden of disease is a global challenge that requires global solutions.
We've been talking a lot about those social and economic factors that influence health, and I imagine those factors play out very differently in different parts of the world.
They do, and that's why international cooperation is so crucial. We need to share knowledge, resources, and best practices across borders to effectively address these complex issues.
So we're talking about things like elaborating on research and development, providing financial assistance to low-income countries, and supporting capacity building in healthcare systems around the world.
Exactly. It's about working together to create a more equitable and just world, where everyone has the opportunity to live a long and healthy life. No country can solve these problems alone. We need each other.
We've covered a lot of ground in this deep dive, from exploring the different categories of the GBD, to understanding the social and economic factors that influence health, to envisioning a future where health equity is a reality for everyone. It's been quite a journey.
It has. And while the challenges are significant, I'm optimistic about the future. We have the knowledge, the tools, and the collective will to make a difference.
I think that's a great note to end on. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive into the global burden of disease. We hope you found it informative and thought-provoking. And remember, even small actions can have a big impact. So let's all do our part to create a healthier world. For ourselves and for generations to come. Until next time, stay curious and keep exploring.